Must start with a brief word of apology. As somebody who's paid really to make sure that the right people are at the right place on the right at the right time, I left the house I'm staying at this morning at 8:15, and I typed the address into my GPS, and it told me that I would arrive at 8:40. And duly, I arrived at 8:40 at the seminary campus on the far side of Greenville. I then discovered just how long trains are in America as I waited at the crossing, and although this is a conference on Calvin, I adopted a very Lutheran attitude to speed limits on the way over, and sinned as boldly as I could when the police weren't looking to get here as close as I could to 9 o'clock. So I do apologize. I know it's the last thing anybody wants is a speaker turning up 5 minutes late on the day of a conference. So I do apologize to you all for that. My brief this morning is to speak on Calvin as theologian. It's the topic that, one of those topics I would put in the category of, it seemed like a good idea at the time when I said I would do it. When I came to actually reflect upon the subject, it struck me that, well, two things. One, the subject is too vast, really, to be covered in any way adequately in a one-hour lecture. And secondly, colleagues always say that I play this card too often, but I am just a historian. I'm very conscious that the other speakers at this conference are far more qualified to speak on the theological aspects of Calvin's life and thought than I am myself. So the approach I'm adopting this morning is I want to look at a series of almost background themes to Calvin as a theologian in order to provide you with perhaps a bit more background to understanding where he is coming from theologically. And my sort of goal is threefold. I want to offer avenues that will allow us to understand Calvin within the ongoing Western theological tradition. Central, it seems to me, to the Reformation is the idea that lack of originality is a good thing. There was only, I think Richard Muller, I've heard him say this in a lecture, so I can't take credit for it, but there was only one original theologian in Geneva in the 16th century, and they burned him precisely because of his originality. The 16th century is not a time for original theology. It is a time for a reward. The reformers themselves would have seen themselves as scripturally repristinating the theology that had always been there. Secondly, I want to reflect a little bit on the Renaissance background to Calvin. Calvin, I think, cannot be understood without understanding something of the background against which he operates. One of the great differences between Calvin and Luther is their educational background. Luther, almost unique among reformers, is very medieval in his educational background, very medieval in many ways in his mindset. Calvin is much more typical of reformers in that his education was decidedly modern compared to that of Martin Luther. And thirdly, in all that I want to say this morning, I want to help you to understand Calvin as operating within the context of Reformation theology, a context which involves a variety of different emphases and concerns, particularly, I think, on that score, his relationship to the theology of Martin Luther. Anyway, to start then by reflecting on Calvin as part of the ongoing Western theological tradition. It's become increasingly apparent over the last 50, 60 years of Reformation scholarship that the old model that saw the Reformation as a clean break with all that had gone before it, or a clean break with all the theology between the year 500 and, say, the year 1500, is not tenable. Both Catholic scholars and Protestant scholars now accept that there are many continuities between what the reformers were doing and what was done in the Middle Ages. It makes sense, of course, if you think about it. If you're studying theology in the 16th century, even under Protestant Reformation professors and teachers, there are many material factors that remain constant from the Middle Ages. If I were to say to you, well, you know, let's say we're in the middle of the 16th century, and I would say to you this morning, go away and write me an essay on Christology. What are you going to do? You're going to leave this room and you're going to go to the library. And when you go to the library, what are you going to find there? You're going to find books. Are those books all published since 1517? No. The majority of books in that library will be medieval books. And you will be exposed to medieval thinking. So it should be obvious, even at a material level, that there must be many continuities between what Reformation Protestants are doing and what was going on in the Middle Ages. If you add to that what I've already said this morning, and that is a basic fear of originality, it becomes inevitable that as a Protestant reformer, and Calvin was no exception to this, you're going to spend a considerable amount of time studying the history of theology within the church. Particularly, I would want to argue, the exegetical tradition of the church. A lot of work has been done on the function of proof texts in the 16th and 17th centuries. Many of you will probably have copies of the Westminster Confession of Faith. If you open the Westminster Confession of Faith, you'll notice there are a series of proof texts printed in the confession. And sometimes you check the proof texts and they don't particularly seem to speak to a particular point that the confession is making. And the question comes to mind, were the people who put these proof texts in, were they mad? Were they incompetent? Was this a bad day? Were they reading a different Bible from the one we have? Well, the answer, of course, is actually those proof texts function in a specific way in the 16th and 17th centuries in a way that can be quite different to the way we think proof texts function today. Proof texts in the 16th and 17th centuries function as exegetical marketplaces. You open your Westminster Confession in the late 17th century and you see a proof text, you don't assume that that proof text gives you a knockdown argument for your opponents on that point. We've all read those tracts, so Roman Catholicism says this, but the Bible says that. And you've just got a statement taken out of context from a Roman Catholic document and then a single line of scripture bunged down on the page, as if sophisticated Catholic theologians don't read the Bible and aren't aware that that verse is there. That's not how they operate in the 16th and 17th centuries. You go back and you check the history of exegesis on the passage that's being referred to. So you open your Westminster Confession, you see the proof text, and then you pull off your shelves the top 10, 20, 30, 40 commentaries that have been written on that passage throughout history, and you read what the great commentators have to say. And by the time you've read what all the great commentators have to say, you probably have a good idea of why that proof text is included at that point in the confession. And Calvin, if you look at Calvin's work, is no exception to this. He has a very high view of post-apostolic exegesis. A key text, I think, in understanding Calvin's theology and his method is the preface to his Romans commentary in 1539, where he makes a series of points about the way exegesis and theology is to be done. And one of the points he makes there is it's important to read post-apostolic exegesis. He has a particular liking for John Chrysostom because of the latter's emphasis on grammatical exegesis. Despite, in some ways, Chrysostom's arguably less than full-blooded anti-Pelagianism. But Calvin is committed to doing his theology in a way that dialogues with the exegetical tradition of the church. Not that he's interested in all of the traditions of the church, but he is interested in the exegetical tradition of the church. And I think it marks Calvin's mindset off and the mindset of his contemporaries off from modern approaches to Scripture. I suspect today if you talk to a typical Bible scholar and ask them, what are you reading on a particular passage, you're unlikely to be told that they're reading anything that was published more than 20 years ago. Part of the reason for that, of course, is that so much gets published today. You just can't read it all. But part of it, I think, is also a different mindset, that the voice of the church was important for the reformers. We should not assume that the reformers were no creed but the Bible people in a radical way that cut themselves off from the history and tradition of the church. The no creed but the Bible people in the 16th century were Anabaptists, and they were punished for it, one might say. Calvin is not a no creed but the Bible person. He has a high view of post-apostolic exegesis. He also engaged to a certain extent with rabbinic exegesis, though research on that has tended to indicate that he derived much of his knowledge of the rabbis, it seems, from helpful compendia. Sebastian Munster's Biblia Hebraica, I think, is particularly significant in that area. But anyway, the first point I want to make is Calvin's theology is done in dialogue with the exegetical tradition of the church. And it perhaps doesn't come as too much of a surprise to us that Calvin has a high view of patristic exegesis. You know, many of us think, well, the church kind of went wrong around about 500, maybe 400, somewhere around about there. And then it got back on the rails again around about 1517. But that brings me to my next point, and that is Calvin's interaction with the medieval tradition. Calvin, of course, does not operate with the kind of distinctions that we have between early church, medieval, Reformation. He can talk about early church fathers as late as the 12th century. Bernard of Clairvaux is a church father for Calvin. For us, he's a medieval guy who preached up a crusade. But for Calvin, he's one of the post-apostolic fathers. Calvin's knowledge of the medieval tradition, however, is, I think, arguably somewhat more limited than his understanding of patristic exegesis. In part, that's due to his schooling. The evidence for Calvin's direct exposure to high-powered medieval scholastic theology, particularly as it would have come through a man called John Major at the University of Paris. John Major was, I'm inclined to say, a boring medieval theologian, not to be confused with the boring Prime Minister of Britain that everyone has now forgotten about, of the same name. Something to do with the name, I think. The evidence for Calvin's learning under Major is somewhat equivocal. Scholars are divided over that. T.F. Torrance places a strong emphasis in his work on Calvin on the connection with John Major. One could perhaps read that through the lens of Torrance's Scottishness, that there's a kind of nationalist concern there to make a Scottish connection. Alexander Ganachi, the Jesuit biographer of Calvin, is somewhat less convinced of a strong connection. What we can say about Calvin, I think we need to, a few things. One, we need to bear in mind that we no longer, or it's no longer tenable to regard Reformation theology as simply opposed to medieval theology. The relationship behind the rhetoric of opposition is much more complicated in general than has typically been understood, certainly prior to post-World War II scholarship. There were many continuities between the concerns of medieval theology and the concerns of the Reformation. Trinitarianism is the most obvious one. But at a deeper level, anti-Pelagianism, an emphasis upon the sovereignty of God and of God's grace, there were many very strong anti-Pelagian theologians in the Middle Ages. And certainly the Reformed were very conscious that when they argued on the issue of Pelagianism, they were not arguing against the whole of the medieval tradition. They had allies within the medieval tradition itself. William Twiss, first prolocutor of the Westminster Assembly, 1617, he's involved in a reprinting of a book by a man called Thomas Bradwardine. Thomas Bradwardine wrote a major book defending God's grace against the Pelagians in the Middle Ages. William Twiss, as a Reformed theologian, was involved in the republishing of a quintessentially medieval book on God's grace. So we need to set Calvin against the background of understanding that there are significant doctrinal continuities between the Reformation and the Middle Ages. There are also common concerns to which the Reformed will give different answers, but they're asking the same questions, if you like. The relationship between the infinite and the finite. The relationship between eternity and time. The relationship between merit and grace. How is it that Adam could be said to merit in a pre-fall situation in the Garden of Eden? That is a question that the medievals wrestled with. They come up with this idea of the super-added gift of grace in the garden that allows a finite human being to merit beyond the finite. Is that familiar? It should be. Covenant of works in Reformed theology. It's a different answer to the same question and the same problem. So some of the questions and issues of the medieval tradition remain hardy perennials for the Reformed. When we come to look at Calvin in detail, a few things need to be said. Many of you will have read your Institutes in Translation and will say, well, Calvin is always bashing scholasticism. He's always attacking scholastics in the Institutes. Surely that indicates that he abominates medieval theology. Well, there are a number of things that one has to bear in mind before we can draw that conclusion. First of all, scholastic is a very ambiguous word. Modern equivalent would be academic. Think of how the word academic functions. When my students write papers for me, I want them to write academic papers. If the paper isn't academic, it's going to fail. It's going to get a poor grade. When I go and hear my students preach, if I come out and say, well, that was a very academic sermon, that's a criticism. It's pejorative in that case. Scholastic functions in exactly the same way. Scholastic simply means it's teaching of the schools. It's academic. Samuel Rutherford, good example of a theologian who will bash scholasticism and scholastics with one breath, and the next minute he's writing a work entitled A Scholastic Disputation on Providence. So the fact that Calvin attacks scholastics doesn't mean, or we shouldn't immediately take that as meaning, that he just wipes out the previous 500 years of theological reflection. You've got to nuance it. You've got to understand how he's using the word. Second thing, and it's actually in the Unaccommodated Calvin book, Richard Muller has done considerable work on comparing the Latin text of Calvin's Institutes with the French text of Calvin's Institutes. Now, bear in mind the different ways those languages functioned in the 16th century. All educated people had access to Latin. In those days, you didn't need to know many languages to be a scholar because all educated people wrote in Latin. So when you write a Latin treatise, you're writing for an educated audience. You're writing for an audience who have some kind of context into which to plug your writings. If you write in the vernacular, you're casting your net more widely. Now, literacy rates are still fairly low in the 16th century. They're beginning to rise, but they're fairly low. But you are casting your net more widely. You're writing for the non-technical, non-specialist audience. And one of the interesting things that Richard has drawn out of this is that Calvin is often less rude in the French than he is in the Latin. And part of that seems to be the result that there's a sort of, you know, as academics we can share these jokes, but we don't want the ordinary people getting in on the act. They have to be a little bit careful about how they talk. More interesting for the point I want to make here is that Richard has shown that in almost every case where the Latin says scholastic, the French says theologian of the Sorbonne. And that's a very significant change. That tells me that when Calvin writes in Latin, he's assuming that his educated audience know who he's talking about. So he doesn't have to be that specific. When he says scholastics, he knows they're talking about the guys who gave him so much grief in Paris when he was there, and the guys who are, as far as he's concerned, holding his homeland in darkness. When he writes for the French audience, he needs to be more precise, because they may not have the background in order to make the connection. So just because Calvin rubbishes scholasticism and scholastics doesn't mean he rejects the last 500 years of theological history. With theologians, as with politicians, you have to look behind the rhetoric and not just listen to what they say, but look at what they do. That's the key thing. So the first point then is Calvin's rhetoric about scholasticism, I'm not saying we dismiss it, but we need to set it within context. Having said that, Calvin does show, I think, a lack of ease and lack of knowledge in his handling of some central points of medieval theology. Most obvious is his dismissal. In Institutes 3:23-2, he dismisses the distinction that the medievals made between God's absolute power and his ordained power. Also does that, I think, in his work on Providence. He says that this distinction between all the things that God can do and then the subset of things that he determines to do makes God arbitrary. And he then goes on to argue for a position that does exactly what the medieval distinction was intended to do. He clearly doesn't understand the medieval distinction and how it was used. And indeed, that distinction comes back into Reformed theology fairly quickly because it was designed precisely to make God, as he has kind of covenanted to be, reliable and not arbitrary. So Calvin's rejection of that medieval distinction on the grounds that he thinks it teaches the exact opposite of what it was actually intended to teach tells me that he's not that well trained and familiar with medieval theology. I think I would go as far as to say I would see that in his hesitation with the language of merit as well, Institutes 3:15. I think if he'd really grasped the various nuances in the way that merit was used in the late Middle Ages, he may have been less concerned about the language. The distinction between meritum de congruo, covenantally determined merit, and absolute intrinsic merit, meritum de cognitio, is critical. Calvin doesn't seem, as I read him, to pick up on all of the subtleties there. Having said that, Calvin, one might say almost, I hesitate, unconsciously, but of course we all stand in the traditions in which we are brought up. Calvin does stand in continuity with medieval thought on a number of points. I've mentioned the anti-Pelagianism. People like Calvin and Luther stand as part of an ongoing Western anti-Pelagian tradition. Also stands, I think, in some continuity exegetically with the Middle Ages as well. From the 12th century onwards, medieval theologians had been increasingly concerned with making the literal sense basic for understanding Scripture. That first signification, whereby words signify things, belongs to the first sense, the historical or literal. That signification, whereby things signified by words have themselves also a signification, is called the spiritual sense, which is based on the literal and presupposes it. Clear statement there that the literal sense of Scripture is to provide the basis for theological exegesis. That statement, of course, does not come from Calvin, comes from Thomas Aquinas. But it's quite consistent, I think, with the kind of exegetical trajectory on which Calvin stands. Calvin is part of a Western tendency away from fanciful allegorical exegesis and towards making the literal sense basic. Having said that, there are areas where Calvin, I think, consciously breaks with the medieval tradition. Started by saying that originality is not highly prized, but there are some things that Calvin does, or I would say the broader Reformed tradition of which Calvin is a part does, that do represent significant breaks and changes from the Middle Ages. Most significant in this regard, I think, is Calvin's argument that Christ is mediator according to both natures. Christ is mediator according to the person. In medieval theology, Christ is regarded as mediator only according to the human nature. That arises out of a Christology that is more speculative in terms of its interest, more metaphysically oriented, and which is wrapped up with really discussion of natures. Calvin and the Reformed turn that on its head. Calvin will argue that Christ is mediator according to the person, according to both natures. What is he doing there? I think it's representative of an increasing focus in Protestantism on sort of anti-speculative attention to the Gospels and to the person of Christ. And this has an extremely constructive impact on Reformation theology. One, it forms a major bone of contention between Protestants and Catholics in the 16th and 17th century. Robert Bellarmine, probably the greatest ever Catholic opponent of Protestantism, flips his lid, one might say, on this issue. He regards the mediation of Christ according to his person, according to both natures, as absolute nonsense. How can it be, he says, that God is mediator between human beings and God? It's nonsense. And Bellarmine, in making that point, pushes Protestantism to reflect upon what? Upon the economic relations between the persons of the Trinity. It's amazing how polemics drive positive theological construction. Calvin makes the move to making Christ mediator according to both natures. Bellarmine counters by saying that's nonsense. The Protestants are then driven back to the drawing board to reflect upon what must have happened in eternity for that to happen in time. And that leads, in the 1640s, to the development of the language of the covenant of redemption. The concept is there before. The term really only emerges 1645, 1646. If ever you've wondered why it isn't in the Westminster Confession, it only emerges in 1645, 1646. It's too late, really, to make it into the Westminster Confession. But the idea of the covenant of redemption emerges in the 1640s because of Calvin and his colleagues' break with the medieval tradition in the 1540s. So then, Calvin's relationship to the Middle Ages. He seems to be more ignorant, one might say, of medieval theology than a man like Luther, but that's partly due to his background. He imbibes a fair bit of medievalism, I think, just through the atmosphere of his education, but has not been as specifically well-trained in medieval theology as others. And as I've said, we need to be careful when we look at his rhetoric about medieval theology and examine what he does, and simply just don't assume that what he says reflects accurately his practice. Next point, more immediate background. The Reformation and Renaissance background. Calvin, unlike Luther, comes to his Reformation convictions via the broad European movement known as humanism. Humanism arises really in the 11th, 12th century in Italian city-states. It's driven by, as the Italian city-states develop, they're looking for historical precedents for who they are. What do? They look back to the era of Greece and Rome. They recover the texts of the classical world in order to provide historical justification for who they are. That's how it starts, but it very soon takes on a life of its own and becomes a major cultural movement. Don't confuse Reformation, Renaissance, humanism with the modern movement associated with people like Julian Huxley and company. It's kind of optimistic atheism. Humanism makes no stand. It's not a theological movement or a philosophical movement on that level. It's a movement of cultural reform. It's a cultural mindset, not so much a metaphysical or theological mindset. And Calvin, like almost every other reformer, with the major exception of Luther, comes to his Reformation convictions through the program of humanism, through this program that saw the transformation of church and society as something that could be achieved through the recovery of classical texts. And it's really only as it becomes clear that humanism cannot deliver on its promises that people like Calvin, Philip Melanchthon, etc., move from being humanists to being more radical reformers, when it becomes clear that the problem is theological and not just cultural. They move from humanism to a more radical Reformation position. How does humanism influence Calvin? Again, one could write tomes on this, but here are three points that touch on his theology. First of all, clearly the bias towards textual study and linguistics that one finds in humanism, this recovery of Greek, the recovery of pristine early texts, the study of ancient texts for wisdom. Clearly, that impacts the way Calvin approaches things. His institutes, not only are they littered with references to early church material, but there are many allusions there to classical authors as well. One of his earliest books, of course, is his commentary on Clemency, written by Seneca, Stoic philosopher from the first century. What a classic humanist thing to do, to produce a commentary on a Latin text. Humanism also impacts Calvin exegetically, however. Again, going back to his 1539 preface to his commentary on Romans, Calvin argues that the goal of interpretation is to understand the mind of the author. To understand the mind of the author. Classic humanist approach to a text. When you read a text, what are you doing? You're trying to think your way into the way that the author of that text thought. And that, of course, spills over into Calvin's exegesis. Most obviously, I think, in his work on the Psalms, What does Calvin do on the Psalms? He's continually thinking himself into the position of the psalmist. Of course, as a historian, I never believe that a single cause causes anything. I work in terms of, you know, there are many influences that lead to one result. Another aspect of Calvin's work on the Psalms, I think, of course, is the fact that he's an exile. He lives most of his life in exile. Won't have much time to talk about that this morning, but that too is significant for understanding him as a theologian. And it's significant for understanding his approach to the Psalms. He's able to think himself into the mindset of the exile. David, constantly being criticized. Calvin is always putting himself in the role of David as the leader who's being beaten left, right, and center. And it all connects beautifully with what he would have learned from his humanist masters. When you read a text, think yourself into the position of the person writing the text. Thirdly, Calvin's work also exhibits a debt to Renaissance rhetorical theory at various points. Renaissance rhetorical theory. For example, the consent of the nations. One of the things you'd learn as a rhetorician in the Renaissance would be, powerful argument is, if everybody's always agreed with it. Everybody believes this. It's a consent of the nations argument. Go back and look at the Institutes and see how often Calvin plays the consent of the nations card. It's sort of there in Institutes 1:1:1, even more in 1:3:1. Since, therefore, Calvin says, men one and all perceive that there is a God and that he is their maker, consent of the nations. Everybody believes this. Don't have to argue beyond the fact that everybody agrees that this is the case. That is Renaissance rhetorical theory. I'm also, I think, persuaded by Richard Muller's argument that the ordering of topics in the Institutes is seen to reflect the understanding of the rhetorical analysis of the commonplaces in the Book of Romans proposed by Luther's assistant, Philip Melanchthon. Another thing you do as a Renaissance rhetorician when you approach a text is you find the commonplace, the heads, the key heads of argument as you work through a text. And I think Richard's essay in The Unaccommodated Calvin makes a good case that the ordering of the Institutes comes increasingly to represent the ordering of topics that Melanchthon sees in the Book of Romans. Romans, of course, simply starts with the knowledge of God and ends with the civil magistrate, a bit like the Institutes. That's how Melanchthon was trained to read the Book of Romans by his humanist masters. Go and find the major topics, see how they connect and flow within the work as a whole. So then, humanism, profoundly influential on Calvin. That brings me then to my next point, and that is the man that I've sort of distinguished from the mainstream of reformers, and that is Luther. Calvin is not only influenced by the humanism of the Renaissance, not only influenced by the more humanistically inclined reformers, he is also hugely influenced, both positively and negatively, by Martin Luther. Calvin shows an early preference for Luther during his exile in Basel. 1534, 1536. He's the contrarian among the Reformed there as having a preference for Luther over Zwingli. This is in the city of Oecolampadius and Myconius. Oecolampadius, of course, was one of the great Reformed advocates at the Castle of Marburg, the Colloquy of 1529, when Lutheranism and Reformed theology break over the issue of Christ's presence in the Lord's Supper. Calvin is on, I mean, Oecolampadius is dead by this point. Dies a rather horrific death from an abscess in his neck. Makes you, sometimes students say to me, which period of history would you like to live at? And I always say, I want to live in this period of history. Antibiotics, flush toilets, there are all kinds of things that you really need. I don't have any romantic views of the 16th century where people died of, an American president. Wasn't Calvin? Who was before Calvin Coolidge as an American president? Herbert Hoover. I think it was Calvin. It was Calvin Coolidge. He was before Herbert Hoover, wasn't he? Calvin Coolidge's, one of his sons died from a blister he picked up playing a tennis game. And that was less than 100 years ago. So really, if anybody says to you, which period of history would you like to have lived in, you want to say, either this one or the one 50 years from now. That's the best. I've forgotten where I got to in my lecture, but I love telling the story of the abscess in the neck. Actually, I'll tell you another of my favorite stories, and this is completely irrelevant to the lecture. But it's my favorite church history story of all time. It's kind of relevant because it refers to Zwingli. Huldrych Zwingli is called to the great minster in Zurich in 1518. And the story was that he couldn't accept the call initially because he'd got the daughter of one of the leading citizens of Zurich pregnant. He wasn't married to her, he got her pregnant. And it was always assumed that this was a piece of Catholic propaganda put around to undermine Zwingli, or maybe Lutheran propaganda. Well, it was late 19th, I think early 20th century. I think it was Alexander Schweitzer, no relation of Albert, but a great German church historian who's working in the archives in Zurich. And he opens a book and a piece of paper falls out. And it's a letter written in Zwingli's hand confessing to fornication, asking for forgiveness as a prelude to accepting the call in Zurich. And the story gets better because Schweitzer's sitting there and he's got a candle on his table, and he reads this, thinks, this is terrible, my hero is being undermined by this. I need to get rid of this. So he sticks it in the candle, and he starts to burn this letter to destroy the only piece of evidence this has happened. And after the letter is about a quarter destroyed, he pulls it out of the candle, extinguishes the flame, and turns to his assistant sitting next to him, and he says, Protestantism is the truth in all circumstances. And he has it filed away in the archives of Zurich. And I believe if you go to the archives, this letter's there, and you see the fire damage that was done to it. But I think that's a great story. And it's a good example of how historians are able, to a certain extent, to overcome their own prejudices, I think, in the assessment of evidence. Anyway, back to the main story. Back to Luther. The Lutheran legacy in Calvin's thinking. First of all, obviously, the non-negotiable importance of justification. I think Mark will be talking more on that this afternoon. I won't spend any more time on that, but to say, if you look at the writings of Zwingli, I think justification is only of marginal importance to Huldrych Zwingli. If you look at what he says about justification, Zwingli has a more transformative understanding of justification than Luther does. I think Calvin is much closer to Luther on justification in terms of both its importance to him and what he understands by it than he is to Zwingli. Secondly, he has a perennially high view of the Lord's Supper. Despite his inability to follow the Christology of Luther, Calvin, of course, maintains a very, very high view of the sacrament, to the extent that this is not a particularly scholarly argument, but in reading his work on the Eucharist, there are times when I've wondered if he's really jumping through hoops in order to try to be as Lutheran as he possibly can, even though he can't go all the way on Christology. That is pure Truman speculation. But it seems to me that there are times when he engages in very unexegetically grounded flights of imagination surrounding the Lord's Supper, which makes me wonder why. Why is he doing this? Thirdly, the theology of the cross. This comes through particularly, I think, in his commentary on the Psalms. But Luther, of course, had this understanding that God reveals himself under his opposite, supremely on the cross of Christ. That God's will is revealed by him doing exactly the opposite of what human wisdom would expect. It's very much kind of 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 idea. That comes through again and again, Calvin's commentary on the Psalms, where suffering is seen as being subverted for the blessing of God. And I think he probably gets that from Luther. It's not, of course, with so many ideas, none of these ideas are exclusive to a particular person. Maybe he just read 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, and he got the idea from there. But certainly, I think his understanding of 1 Corinthians would have been reinforced by his knowledge of Luther's theology. The other area, and this is where I want to mark him off from Luther, however, and this is one that is not, that is sometimes, I think, missed, but it does affect how we should understand his theology and his emphases. And that is, Calvin, I think, has a fundamentally different understanding of what is going on in the 16th century to that which we find in Luther. What do I mean by that? Luther thinks he's living at the end of time. And Luther identifies the problem in the medieval Catholic Church as the burying of the gospel under a lot of garbage. Luther is a strong eschatological expectation in Luther. The evidence for that I would give would be Luther's change of mind on the Jewish question. 1523, he writes this treatise that Jesus Christ was born a Jew. Very, very positive about the Jews. 1543, he writes one of the most notoriously negative books ever written on the Jews and their lies. And often people tend to focus on the second one and say, well, why did Luther write such terrible things about the Jews in 1543? In fact, if you look at writings about the Jews in the 15th, 16th century, you find that Luther's 1543 treatise is pretty conventional. It engages in extreme rhetoric, but the ideas it contains are fairly conventional. Accuses the Jews, for example, of engaging in child sacrifice. That is a typical accusation, medieval accusation against the Jews. The interesting thing about Luther's writing on the Jews is not his 1543 treatise, where he's angry and nasty. The interesting thing is that he ever writes a positive treatise about the Jews in 1523. Why does he do that? He does that because he thinks it's the end of time. He thinks the Jews are about to be converted and is expecting the gospel to carry all before it. He's so bitter in 1543 because he's approaching the end of his life. The Reformation is starting to suffer severe setbacks. And he's beginning to realize that that great end time revival isn't going to happen. And he scapegoats the Jews. The Jews are so stubborn, they simply will not turn. That gives an insight, I think, into Luther's overall understanding of what's going on in the 16th century. It's the eschaton. It's the end of time. After Diet of Worms, 1521, Luther is being popularly identified as one of the two witnesses in Revelation. He never identifies himself that way. It's always a sign of madness, I think, generally speaking, when you identify yourself with a figure in Revelation. But he never repudiates the identification, which is interesting. For Luther, the Reformation is all about the recovery of the gospel that's been buried. Switch to Calvin and the Reformed. For the Reformed, the Reformation is a crusade against idolatry. Now, there are many points of contact between the Reformed and the Lutheran, not least justification by faith. But the understanding of the times is different. For Calvin, as for Zwingli, as for Farel, they're living in a time where the problem is idolatry. And what does that mean? It means that when they write on what the Reformation's doing, one of the first things they zero in on is worship. And some of the first things they zero in on are idolatrous ceremonies. If you go to Luther, writing on 1 John 5:21, little children, keep yourselves from idols. What does Luther say about that passage? He says, this passage doesn't apply anymore because there are no idol temples around. This was written in the first century at a time when there was extensive paganism and there were temples where there were idols. Luther says, doesn't apply in the 16th century. Why doesn't it apply? Because our problem is not idolatry. Our problem is the burying of the gospel. If you look to Calvin, you look to Farel, you look to Zwingli, you get a very, very different attitude. The focus in Calvin's writings often is on worship in a way that finds no parallel in Luther whatsoever. I was even yesterday looking at Luther's Shorter Catechism in class with students, and we noticed that in the little book on baptism at the end, when the child comes to be baptized, Luther makes a reference that at this point the child is brought to the altar. Why does he make that reference? Well, he makes that reference because they're following the exact pattern that was followed in the medieval times. The child would be kept at the door of the church until the moment of baptism itself. After the prayer of exorcism had been said, the child would then be brought to the altar and baptized. You cannot imagine a Reformed theologian having that kind of attitude to medieval liturgical practice. Because, of course, medieval liturgical practice was an essential part of the problem for the Reformed. So that's why when you turn to Calvin, you will find a focus, I think, on idolatry that you will not find elsewhere. And again, it connects with Calvin's humanism. Farel, in his 1529 Sommaire, talks about the idolatry of the Mass. And what's the problem with the Mass? It deflects money from the poor. There's a social concern. As Erasmus one day is walking through the streets, I think it's of Oxford, and he's with Dean John Collett, and Collett sees some monks putting some money at a little roadside altar, and turns to Erasmus and says, "What do you think about these men worshipping the image of God?" And Erasmus says, "If they want to worship the image of God, then they should give the money to the one who bears God's image." And he points to a poor man lying in the gutter. That's much more, I think. You see there the humanist idea that the church's practices need to be reformed, flowing through into a more radical theological version in the thinking of Calvin. And again, as it's always nice to confirm one's theories by going and looking at the texts. How many historians build their theories and then hold the texts into the candle when they don't agree? But I think if you go to Calvin's reply to Sadoleto, what does Calvin say? "I have no difficulty," he says, "in conceding to you that there is nothing more perilous to our salvation than a preposterous and perverse worship of God." Luther would have talked there about works righteousness, trust in oneself. Calvin talks about worship. On the necessity of the reforming the church, what does Calvin say? "The following two not only occupy the principal place, but comprehend under them all the other parts, and consequently the whole substance of Christianity." What are they? First, a knowledge of the mode in which God is duly worshipped, and secondly, of the source from which salvation is obtained. So my final comment in Calvin's relationship with Luther is, there's much he draws from Luther: justification, high view of the sacrament. But for all of their agreement, there is a fundamentally different understanding of what is going on in the 16th century at work between the Reformed and Luther. Luther's living at the end of time. It's just a question of recovering the gospel. For Calvin, the problem is idolatrous worship. Now, in terms of theological statements, that may lead to a huge amount of common ground between the two. But in terms of actually understanding what is going on in history, I think there is a significant difference. So then, I see I'm running out of time and I don't want to keep you from your coffee. But just to summarize, where have I gone this morning? One, in understanding Calvin as a theologian, we need to understand that he's not trying to be original. He has a high view of the exegetical tradition of the church. And that isn't just the exegetical tradition of the first 500 years. Throughout church history, the theologian, the properly equipped theologian for Calvin, must be familiar with the whole sweep of churchly exegesis over the centuries. Secondly, while there is much in Calvin that stands in continuity with the medieval world, because there are so many continuities, Calvin's self-conscious interaction with medieval theology is not as finely tuned as one would find, let's say, in a man like Martin Luther, who had a specifically medieval education. Thirdly, humanism influences Calvin. Text and linguistics, exegesis, rhetoric. And finally, there is the all-important relationship with Martin Luther. There is one other relationship, I've run out of time, that I wanted to talk about. I will mention it briefly. Martin Bucer. Can't leave without talking about Bucer. Bucer, I think, influences Calvin in two distinct ways. One, in his understanding of the relation of church and state. Calvin first gets his real vision of the freedom of the church from his time with Bucer in Strasbourg, 1538 and following. But secondly, Bucer has a sort of good news, bad news impact on Calvin as well. Bucer was without doubt the preeminent biblical exegete of his day. And his attention to the text and his attention to grammatical exegesis has an influence on Calvin. He was also one of the most long-winded people of his day. Calvin politely alludes to this again in that 1539 preface. What did Bucer do? Every time Bucer hits a theological commonplace, he's a humanist too, in a book of scripture, he writes a major treatise on that commonplace within the commentary itself. It makes the commentaries immensely long and boring and repetitive. It leads to occasional bizarre comments in his commentary, such as, you know, my publisher's demanding the text from me, I need now to move quickly, so you get a huge chunk of work on the first few chapters in Ephesians, and the last few chapters are dispatched very quickly because the press are breathing down his neck. Calvin is influenced positively in terms of Bucer's attention to the text. But it also leads him to do what? To draw out the commonplaces of the letters of Paul and set them up in a separate volume. Of course, that volume is the Institutes. Why does Calvin write shorter commentaries than Bucer does? Why does, and the title of this lecture is Brevitas and Claritas. I guess I should mention that at some point. I do think if you read enough Calvin, there are times when one wonders exactly how much Brevitas and Claritas there was there, particularly I think in his lectures on Jeremiah that simply go on forever and ever and are unremittingly depressing on the whole. But then so is the book of Jeremiah, one might say. He's only working with the material that the Lord has given him at that point. But Calvin writes concise commentaries because he lifts out the commonplaces and puts them in the Institutes. And when you read your commentaries and Calvin says, yeah, I've dealt with this in more detail in another place, that's code for go and look it up in the Institutes. The Institutes is not a systematic theology. It contains theology, but it's not intended as a systematic theology. It's one of the reasons why it looks different from Turretin's Institutes. Two books were intended for entirely different purposes. One would expect them to look different. Calvin's Institutes is an exegetical handbook to the commentaries. And of course, that ties in very nicely with the fourth comment he makes in on method he makes in his 1539 commentary on Romans, and that is that exegesis and theology are to exist in this beautiful symbiotic relationship. And I think Calvin's theology, in terms of the way he relates the Institutes, the commentaries, is a good example of that in action. I'm sorry I've overrun my time by a few minutes, so I must give my second apology for the morning, but I believe we break for coffee now.